Hey guys, I have really sad news. A great human being and musician and dear friend of mine, Matt Harris, passed away yesterday from liver failure. Sad. He was a multi-instrumentalist, amazing bass player and singer that he was most known for. And being just a wonderful human being. He had a band called Oranger. He was a bass player in the Posies. He played with Rocky Erickson. He played with Ian Moore and a lot more people. And I met him when I played with Ian Moore when he released the To Be Loved album. And I became his touring guitar player, keyboard player, and backup singer guy. Matt Harris was the bass player on that tour, and he was my roommate on that tour. And so for a few months, I spent 24 hours a day with Matt. And I enjoyed every second of it. We had an amazing connection from the get-go. He was such a smart human being and knew about everything. Like, he knew about everything. And he had friends in every city in this whole country that we went through. Like, I went around the whole United States with that dude. And he was always had this is one of my best friends. But it's true. He was close with everyone and everybody loved him. He had this magnetic personality. He was a huge fan of music. He was a huge supporter of his friends who were musicians. And he played on my El Payaso album on the song Bad Man. He played bass and sang backup. And he was a great musical foil for Ian. I think some of the best stuff that Ian has ever done was when he and Matt really started collaborating after that tour. I was sad to leave that tour because I was sad to leave Matt and our daily routine. Like, we woke up together on days off together. We would go do shit together. Like, we just hung out together 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. For a couple of months, man, it was... Oh, man. It's such a sad loss. I'm so sorry for his dad, Zeke. I got to meet his mom before she had passed away. I stayed at his place in Palm Springs. That's where he lived. That's where he passed away. I'm really going to miss Matt. I really, really love him. I talked to him in December when I was at the beach with my family. When I was on a walk one day and we talked about getting together, doing some music stuff. Just, fuck, man. Anyway, I'm glad I have this podcast. It's from August of 2013. And I don't know what he was in town for. Maybe visiting his dad because his dad lives here. Maybe he was here doing some stuff with Ian at the time because he was still playing with him. But anyway, I love Matt so much. And I'm glad we got to have this conversation. I'm glad I have it and I can listen to it forever. Rest in peace, brother. I love you. Everybody's trying to find a payoff. Everybody's trying to find a payoff. Everybody's trying to find a payoff. Looking for a cheap thrill. Everybody thinks they're in the sunshine. Everybody thinks they're in the sunshine. Everybody thinks they're in the sunshine, standing in the shadows. I'm gonna stay at this field till the kids are revealed. Did you guys play that song every night?
Every night.
Oh, yeah.
It was a lot faster.
Yeah? Yes, it's a fast-going song. Hey, that's an album that I wish I was on. When I listened to it, I'm like, oh, man, what did I do wrong?
Yeah, I wish you were on that too, actually. Yeah. There is a lot of guitar on that album. I think a lot of that, though, was Ian. I played a little bit of guitar on it.
Yeah?
Surprisingly, let me. Thanks, Ian.
Your drumming on the demos is amazing.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
And that's Kyle Schneider, the great Kyle Schneider.
The great Schnittleston. He basically was pretty stoked on those parts and just aped them straight up off the demos, which was great.
Well, they're great.
He added his muscle and time to it better than mine, but...
And you guys got together because that was the first time Ian really got with someone and did stuff.
Yeah, and was songwriting.
I know you wrote the songs and you just kind of moved into.
Yeah, place we did the whole record pretty much that way. I went up to the island, like two or three different 3-week stints.
The island.
The island. It's really conducive for writing. It's so beautiful up there. Have you been up there at all or no?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man. It's.
I haven't been to his place, but I've been to that island, and I camped out. He wasn't there.
Yeah, his place.
I didn't camp out like on his yard.
You could have. It's big enough. No, it was great just going up there and working and like waking up, drinking coffee, having breakfast, and we talk about, you know, whatever the current event was that we were kind of thinking about. Or at that time, he and I were trading a lot of books.
Right.
So I would read a book like... what was Sin in the Second City, Karen Abbott, about the first America's first brothel. That's what Bell My Butterfly goes into sort of detail with, throwing Jack Johnson, state's witness. Bell Schreiber was one of the butterflies that worked in the prostitution ring there. And anyway, so we were bouncing that stuff off of each other, and that really seems to work well for us, I think.
And then how would you guys record them? Just like you'd sit at the drums and he would play guitar and you'd start cutting them?
We'd drink a lot of coffee.
Yeah.
And then we would sit in
the living room. That's why everything's so fast.
Exactly. And we would sit in the living room, and he would usually, maybe two of us with guitars, just acoustics. He would have an idea. We'd kind of flesh through it, come up with an arrangement. He might have some rough words. Then we'd jump in the studio. He'd jump on guitar. I'd jump on drums, and we'd try and bang out a tune.
That's awesome. And then so by the end of a song a day?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, by the end of the day, we'd have a rough idea of a song. We'd come back in the next morning, listen to it, make sure that we liked how it was, finish it up, and then drink a bunch of coffee and do it again. So it was great. So we did that, I think, 3 separate 3-week chunks. So over the course of that time, over, you know, maybe that was 6 months, we did that.
Yeah.
We got a lot done. And we still had a shitload of outtakes. Still, I mean,
tons of songs,
tons of
that's
stuff.
Great.
So, I mean, we're, you know, he just did that 30 songs in 30 days, and
he
barely even scraped on some of the stuff that we had done. It was really cool, actually. It was extreme. I wish you could ask him about it. We should call him, but he's camping right now in Oregon. It was a daunting task, I think, once he took it on, and he realized also there was no real digital platform for something like that for you to sell. That kind of a thing. There's nothing out there. And so he kind of sort of created something that was really neat in that sort of digital realm. But, you know, it was basically 30 songs in 30 days, and you could subscribe to it and you could pay 99 cents a song, so $30. Or it was kind of a sliding scale thing. So I think all the girls that subscribed to it paid $30 and all the dudes paid like $4 or something. So.
Well, so, and then he released a song every single day.
He did,
and they
actually
were just songs he had lying around, and he was writing songs too. Or?
He was writing a lot of stuff. He also had some stuff sitting around. I think he did a lot of preparation for it. So once it started running, you know, the train doesn't really stop at that point. And it was cool. So we played on this last tour. We played a couple of the songs from that session, from those 30 songs in 30 days, which were really cool. We did a song about Harvey Gann, who is Austin's notorious drug cop, DEA cop, or whatever. You know, he's the guy who was responsible for trying to bring the whole hippie movement down in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And he wrote a really cool song about him. You know, he was very diligent in his job, so you have to admire somebody who's super diligent. But, you know, a lot of people, you know, hey, man, he's the man, you know, going against him. And so Ian kind of wrote it with a little bit of a twist on his perspective. But it also is about Rocky, you know, the third verse in there is really great. We played it live on KUTX. So.
Did you play for Rocky?
I did.
Yeah.
For a few years. That was a lot of fun. That was really...
No, but did you play the song for Rocky?
No, but I called Jagar, actually, when we did it. And I said, hey, man, listen on the air, because we're doing a song that's about Harvey Gann.
Oh, cool.
And the third verse is about Rocky. And he was like, no way. And so he sent me a text back after it. And he was like, that's awesome. And he showed up to the Continental show the next night and was totally stoked. So.
That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah, so that 30 song for 30 days, man, that is a lot of work. Yeah. I wouldn't want to do it. I couldn't do it. I couldn't write that much shit. So
you don't think so? You get a little setup like this, like a studio going. I mean, when I was at your place in Palm Springs.
Yeah. I could probably do it, but I can't write like Ian can. He can just really crank shit out. He can write lyrics really well.
Yeah.
You know, he's really, really good at that. I can sit down and flesh stuff out with him.
Jams.
Yeah, he can bring a 10-second idea and we'll have a song by the end of the day. You know, we can do that for 30 days, no problem, but we would be fried. I mean, he was physically and mentally just toast. I talked to him like on day 23 and he was like, why did I do this? Why?
Well, I bet you can raise some money pretty fast.
He did. You'd have to ask him, I mean, but if I'm not mistaken, I think he had over 500 or 600 people that bought into it. So, fantastic. I mean, yeah, he did really well and it was a really good thing. And it was great feedback for him to get the fans to kind of say, hey, we really like this, or meh, you know, this one's not so good, or, you know, he got a lot of feedback, and those were kind of the songs where you're like, maybe we should kind of focus on this stuff or go in this direction. So it's really
almost a focus group.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really what it is. So it's
okay. So you said you played with Rocky. Sorry, but you're a California kid, but you have strong Texas ties.
Born in Texas.
You were born in Texas.
Born
where?
In Texas, Wichita Falls.
Wow.
Way up north, right on the border.
Yeah.
Red River. The Red River. Lovely
you know, that's
place.
Where when my family moved from Cuba, they moved to Miami. They lived there for a couple years. My grandfather got an internship because he's a doctor in Wichita Falls. So this Cuban family moved to Wichita Falls in like 1965.
Dude, the only thing in Wichita Falls is Gene's Hamburgers and Stanley's Barbecue. Only two things I can remember.
My aunts, and none of them will talk about that time. They're just like, it was awful. Like, you know, they went in and then people were super racist. But you come from like cool, hippie parents.
Yeah, my parents, all four of them are very cool. You know, yeah. Zeke and Sally out here, my Texas folks, they are both born, raised Wichita Falls.
Okay.
My mother is California. Yeah. My stepdad is California. So they're the California angle of it. I had a very interesting record collection between everybody, between my mom, my aunt, my uncle.
Well, yeah, your
and
dad's
my dad.
A massive music fan.
Oh, absolutely.
And so is your mom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I got the Beach Boys, and I got, you know, a lot of the California Jan and Dean stuff from her. And from my dad, I got ZZ Top, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of the Texas roots stuff and, you know, Bob Wills.
Well, you have a strong reverence, I think, for Texas. Like,
oh, I love
it. The Texas, like Doug Somm, like this Willie.
Absolutely.
Obviously, Rocky Erickson. So what was that like? Was your dad was he like a 13th floor elevators guy at the time? So was he like...
He definitely was aware and knew. I mean, you know, everybody, all of my folks knew You're Gonna Miss Me.
Right.
And they were very familiar with
that.
The
song's fucking amazing.
Which is killer.
Yeah.
My dad was really excited, though, when I did that. It's funny. I can tell you a really funny story about the first gig I did with Rocky. And that was with Kyle Ellison, Kyle Schneider, myself, and Rocky.
That's a great band.
And it was really fun. We were like Rocky's Black Sabbath lineup.
Yeah.
It was pretty awesome, actually. We did all the, like, really, you know, the evil 170 stuff, just like real heavy.
Does he still do two-headed dog or three-headed dog?
Two-headed dog, yeah. Working in the Kremlin with a two-headed dog.
Yeah,
he still does that. So we did this, you know, we did the rehearsals and... You know, it's Rocky, so you sit down and you hang out, and you have to kind of hang out and talk with Rocky, and he's really cool. He's very
lucid now.
Absolutely.
He's not in kind of the cloud and haze that, like, the 80s and 90s were
right
for him.
He still has some moments,
sure,
which is fine, and this is kind of where the story is going.
Okay.
So we've done, you know, we've got this great 15-song set list, and I think the first gig we did was the Houston Continental. And so Zeke is with me standing off to the side of the stage, and we're playing. I think we get to, you know, the second song or something, and I call out, I can't remember what it was, I call it out, and he's like, okay, and we play it, and he get to the third song, and I say, hey, Rocky, we're going to do, you know, Cold Night for Alligators. He's like, okay, is this the last one? And I was like, what? I go, no, man, we still got 12 songs to go. I wasn't expecting that, so... And I just, you know me doing my what?
Yeah.
And my dad's just on the side rolling over laughing. So it was pretty funny. Anyway, to say the least, we wound up touring all over Europe and doing a lot of Scandinavia and a lot of big festivals with him. I wound up playing. One year we did the, what was that festival we did in, it was way up, you're in the Arctic Circle in Norway. And it was on the 4th of July. And I remember playing at midnight and the sun was up in the sky.
Oh, yeah.
And
it one
was
of those,
just like, yeah,
it stays all day.
It stayed light, and it stayed light all day and all night. It was such a trip.
What was that like? Like, what were the crowds? Are people just like, was that his first time there in like decades or something? Or like,
I think he had been over there earlier with the Explosives a few years before.
Okay.
And I think Troy Campbell had kind of gotten some other lineups. They had been over there. I'll tell you one thing. with Rocky. I have never been to a show. We did two shows, I think, at the Houston Continental over the course of the period of time when I was in there. And I'd never seen more girl fights in my life than at those two shows. Really? Like, I saw at one show, there were three girl fights in front of Kyle Ellison on the right side of the stage, like a chola and a fucking punk rock girl just going at it. Just
were they fighting over Kyle?
I think they were fighting over space of getting up front and wanting to be there. And, you know, that happened a couple of times, you know. And then the next time we played there, it was like, bam, bam, girl fight. And we're like, woo, oh, shit. Never seen that before. That's only with scary. Rocky. I guess he brings out the girl fight, the cat fighters to the crowd.
So, let's go back. So, how did your parents take you to shows? Like, how long did you live in Wichita Falls? You didn't grow up there.
I spent my early years, like first grade through third grade there. Okay. I was born there, and the year after I was born, I moved to California, to Northern Cal, and then moved back out around, I moved back out to Texas around, I want to say third or fourth grade, something like that. Maybe second or third, somewhere in there. I can't remember. Maybe at the end of first. And I was out there again for a few years. And then my folks split up, and then I went back to California and wound up staying out there pretty much until I graduated high school. So from like 79 until I graduated in 87.
Okay.
So I didn't really spend any of my formative musical years, although I did start learning how to play music in Wichita Falls.
Okay.
I started playing cello in first grade there, so.
Wow, what was that? Did you want to play cello, or did they?
No, I wanted to play, piano really bad, but they said my hands were too small. So they were like, you can play cello. I think they just went around and they just said, cello, violin, viola. You know, they just needed to fill slots.
Did you like it when you were playing? Like, were you excited to come home and practice?
Because that's
always the litmus test. Did you do it when you were alone?
I did. Yeah, I enjoyed playing it. And I still I wound up playing upright bass and going to college and studying that and playing classical music and jazz for years at Cal State Northridge for a long time in L.A. and wound up doing a lot of that. So, I mean, my roots are still classically based, and I always, you know, you ask anybody in any of my family, and they'll tell you they can tell when I've been in the car because the radio is generally on a classical station and not a rock station.
Yeah.
Anybody else gets in and it's...
Well, you're also an incredible fan of music. Like, you have a great, you can pull out any band and genre out the top of your... From being on tour with you, I was always astounded at how much you knew about music, especially even underground music.
I listen to a lot of shit.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time going through Waterloo when I'm in town, especially they have a killer international section of psych music right now from Turkey and all kinds of weird stuff.
Can you describe what is psych music?
Oh, geez, that's a good question.
I mean, is it...
Well, Rocky coined it. I mean, he's the guy that said psychedelic rock. I'm pretty sure he was the first person. So, you know, it would be something in the realm of drug-oriented music if I had to make a guess.
Of course.
You know, I mean, psychedelic.
I mean, would you say My Bloody Valentine is psych rock?
Oh, absolutely. I would say they're a modern twist of psych. It's, you know, it's very ethereal and washy, and it has elements of you know, uplifting you without drugs, so to speak. You know, that to me is like the elevators have that. You listen to some of that stuff and you're just so moved by it emotionally. Like, wow, how is that possible? That's psychedelic to me.
You know what? I think the electric jug is a great idea, but like, if you listen to it,
I would have hated
it. Weird. It's like just some guy like...
Can you imagine like every night of tour for like 4 or 5 months of that? I would have blown my brains out.
It seems like something the fried pie would
exactly.
be
into. Exactly.
Guys, I got a jug.
Yeah, exactly. I can't play this. Can I play the jug? And then, you know, it's funny. I was, when Ian and I were finishing up this tour and we had that Harvey Gann song, I was like, you know what we should do at the end on that last verse is we should put jug in it.
Yeah.
I had totally said that. Just
see?
Just a little bit. Just so it's like in between these little verses, there's this it's the last tagline of the song. And it would just be a little quick. And that's it. Because I don't want anybody playing that shit on tour.
No,
ever.
Not the whole time, no. Hey, so did you have bands in high school? Like, were you in bands?
I played in one band.
What'd you play?
I played guitar, and I learned Day Tripper and Eye of the Tiger. Those were the two songs, two songs I wanted to play really bad. That was like in junior high. And then I never really played. I played in a band played in a band in high school called Cygnus. We were big Rush fans.
Okay.
We played the talent show and we did
Signals?
Cygnus. Oh. From Cygnus. We're in our yearbook. Actually, there's a full page spread of us. I have to dig up the photo and email it to you. You'll laugh your ass off. I think I had spiked hair and I'm wearing a white turtleneck and shorts with espadrilles. Playing a white Strat. I wanted to be Alex Lifeson. What could I say?
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, we were big Rush lovers, and we played in our talent show. I think we did the whole first side of 2112.
Wow.
Was our entrance, and it was pretty funny.
Did you have any smoke machines or anything?
No, I wish we did. That would have been really cool. But bass player played a Steinberger. You know, I had the checkered shirt with the corduroy tie and the cargo pants with the white Strat. And
perfect.
We had a drummer with too many drums who couldn't play them. Yeah, exactly. It was like, into the next day.
So when you went to college, you were going to do it, you were going to study music?
No, initially I went in studying nursing, and I wanted to be a doctor. So I was at the end of high school, I was like, fuck music. I don't want to do this anymore. And I wanted to be a nurse. I'd gone into, you know, I was a lifeguard. I was doing swimming and water polo for a long time. Wanted to be an EMT, work my way into nursing, do all of that. My first semester, I totally bombed anatomy and physiology. And I'm sitting in the cafeteria at the junior college where I'm at. And the music director, who I'd known for years, he'd come up to me and he goes, well, I just looked at your transcripts and you're not going to make it as a nurse, but you should play bass. So he kind of pulled me back into the fold, and here I am.
So did you started studying?
I started studying. Okay. Yeah. And that's when I started seriously studying. I studied percussion as well, like classical percussion, played in orchestra.
And where was that?
And that was in Northern California, Los Medanos College. It was a junior college. Did that for 3 years and then transferred to Northridge down in LA. I thought I was going to be a session player. That was fun.
So you go to LA, you transfer down there, and what were you doing? Like, did you have a job or were you in a band?
I had a job. I didn't have a band in my first year. Just
what was the job?
Studying classical music. Worked at Warehouse Records, of course. Cool. Had a music related job.
Yeah.
I had to. And then it was the second year. The drummer who I had gone to school with in Northern California had gone the year before me to Northridge and said, you should come here. And so that was Jim, who wound up being the drummer of Oranger down the road. We've known each other since high school pretty much for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And so so I kind of followed him down. And then I studied the first year, studied with Ed Mears, a classical guy who's been a major session classical bass player in LA for every orchestral date. He was one of the dudes. He was like 19 appointed by Sir Neville Mariner as the principal bass player for the LA Chamber Orchestra. Wow. I mean, he was crazy. He played so much, he had blown out all of the nerves in his fingertips, and he had to have these prosthetic fingertips made. And he would wear those when he played. So when he played with his left hand, you'd hear it clicking.
Oh,
he couldn't.
Weird.
Yeah, he couldn't. He had no nerve feeling in the ends of his fingers. But amazing player. He played he's been on every Randy Newman orchestral session. He's the principal bass player. Really, really great guy. Taught me a lot. Really, really cool dude.
So is that? And that was in the early 90s.
That was in the early 90s.
And is that when you started Oranger? Did you start?
We started
Oranger?
Actually. Jim and I had a band with a buddy of ours by the name of Alan Stewart. We had a couple of previously, we had a few earlier guitar players than Alan. There was this guy, Rich Severinsen, and we had a guy, Emile Poiré, who's a great jazz guitar player now in LA, played with us. But Alan, Jim, and I really sort of solidified the band Stick Figures, and we really wanted to be a ska band. We really wanted to be like the Police kind of thing. And there it was, I remember we did a lunch show, a noontime show at college, and we opened for No Doubt.
Oh, that's awesome.
And they were nobody. They were like, wow, you're doing ska too?
Were they like a San Diego, like Orange County? Something?
They were an Orange County band.
Kind of like a popular
they were,
local
they,
band.
They were, yeah, they were great, though. I mean, you could tell then that they were going to be something huge just because of their energy on stage and the way that they presented themselves and the way that they were really awesome. I just remember seeing Gwen thinking, wow, that chick really wants it.
Yeah.
And this is they're playing the Palomino the night after us or wherever we're playing, the crappy clubs out in you know,
California,
the Captain's Club or the Rockaway or whatever all of those weird places were.
When didn't you guys end up going to San Francisco?
We did. I wound up, well, what happened was I wound up leaving LA and going to San Francisco, and I wound up joining Overwhelming Color Fast and playing guitar in that band. Yeah, they were a Relativity Records band, really popular, produced by Butch Vig right before Nirvana's Nevermind came out.
Okay.
And they had done their first record, and I had originally, right before I went to LA, they had asked me to play guitar in the band, and I did the demos, and then I said, well, I'm going to go study jazz, sorry boys.
Right.
And took off, and then I came back and they were like, "Hey, we need a guitar player." And so that's kind of my real entry into the professional rock world, is with Bob Reed, Dan Reed, and Steve Espinola. Those guys being, those were the guys that kind of brought me into the whole thing. And Bob was the one who was like, on tour he would totally grill me. He would drive, smoke a lot of cigarettes, drink a lot of coffee, and he would control the tape deck, and he would always play me stuff and say, guess who this is, you know. He'd always try and fuck me over too. He'd be like, okay, check this out. He'd play Lies, the Knickerbockers, and he'd say, what Beatles song do you think this is? Have you ever heard this? And I'm like, I've never heard this. This is crazy. It's not the Beatles, you know. So it's like that kind of an education. So it was great though. I mean, it really, he sort of helped me unlearn everything I learned in college and gave me more street cred,
right,
to that degree. So,
was that what the scene was going on in San Francisco at the time? Like a Jellyfish kind of?
Jellyfish was just kind of happening right after that. So out of Overwhelming Color Fast, I had moved over, as I always have. I get pushed over. Once I play guitar in a band, it seems like I get canned from playing guitar and they make me play bass, which is fine. Mike Drake joined Overwhelming Color Fast, and then Mike and I left Color Fast to start Oranger.
Okay.
And that's how the birth of Oranger happened.
And so explain Oranger, because you guys did a lot of touring, made records.
We did.
Big tours.
We did. We got lucky. Oranger was great. Mike and I really wanted to be a band like The Who, and we wanted bands to hate playing after us. We wanted to absolutely just destroy anybody and everybody. And we hated headlining. We always loved the middle slot, because then people would have to play after us. Yeah. And we just wanted to, you know, we were just like, here we go. You know, we were totally up for the rock challenge. You know, that's pretty good, but how about some rock and roll? You know, that was sort of our attitude. And we really were that way. We were real assholes in that sense. And at that point, Jim had moved to Iowa and was playing in some cover band, touring out there. And at some point, I was like, I called him up and said, hey, I'm flying out like in 2 days and I'm picking you up and you're moving. And he's like, okay. And so I flew out. He picked me up at the airport. We rented a U-Haul, loaded his shit up, and drove out to California, and Oranger was born. And that was kind of how it all started. Mike and I had talked about it. We sort of had an idea of what we wanted to do. I think initially we were kind of really into that band Failure.
Uh-huh.
We really loved that stuff because it was real heavy. But as Jim sort of came into the fold and we were really starting to get more into the 60s kind of vibe, and
right,
we started really listening more to Beach Boys and to The Who and you know, to a lot of that stuff, probably ingesting more drugs than we probably should have at that period of time as well. Sorry, folks. It just sort of naturally occurred and led down to that road. And Oranger was really fun. I mean, we did some great tours. We got to tour with Elliot Smith, Guided by Voices. We did tons of shows with the Muffs. I mean, we've toured with and played with a bunch of bands. And it was really cool. It just sort of, you know, we did our last show last year at Noise Pop. It was, shit, we hadn't seen Jim in 8 years or talked to him.
Wow.
And so we had the original lineup play, and we did it was a great show. It was the original lineup of Overwhelming Color Fast and the original lineup of Oranger on the same bill.
Oh, wow.
And it was at Bottom of the Hill. It was awesome, and it was really fun, and I'll never do it again because I want to leave it at that point.
Yeah, it was
such a high point that, you know, it's time to move on.
So how did it end the first time before you guys got back together last year? Like, how did it end? How did you guys?
In Austin, ironically, at South by 1 year. Jim had had enough with Oranger, and Oranger had had enough with Jim, and so it kind of split. And for about a year, Mike and I really didn't know what we were going to do. And then somehow or another, I actually do not remember how this happened, but we wound up making a connection. Oh, I do actually, through Wendy Wilson. We made a connection with John Hofer from the Mother Hips, the drummer.
Okay,
and we were in New York City hanging out with him during Oranger had played a show, and he and Mike and I and Bob had hung out. And at that point, I think Mike and I kind of looked at each other and were like, you know, we should get him to play drums with us. And so John wound up playing drums with us for a good...
They're like from Chico,
six
right?
6 years, yeah. And he did the last Oranger record that we did, New Comes and Goes. That's John playing drums on that. John never wanted to play any of the early shit that Jim did because he always said, he was like, I can't be Jim. Why the fuck would you want me to play those parts? So we never, you know, it was fun getting back together with Jim and not playing those first two or three records.
Right.
We hadn't played them in almost a decade. So it was really fun playing that stuff. I won't lie at all. I loved it. And it was crazy. And the energy was fun. But, you know, it was just, also it's like old habits never die sometimes. And when you, you know. I think Mike and Jim never really got along all the time, and so that tension immediately was sort of right back into the mix. And we're all older, wiser, you know.
See,
everybody's got families now. Mike's got two kids, married, lives in New York now. So it's like everything was just kind of going in its own direction.
Is he still playing?
He is still playing some. I don't know what he's doing out in New York other than working. He works for the Orchard for Sony now.
Okay,
so he's doing really good. So I'm very happy for him, and I hope he's got a room for me to stay and visit.
So what did you do then? Did you move to Seattle?
No.
Or when? How did you get the Posies?
I moved to Palm Springs. The Posies saw me play with Oranger, one of the last shows. It was actually that last South By that we did with Jim.
Oh.
We played at Buffalo Billiards, and we did the, I think it was the Arena Rock Records Showcase or something, and... Barbara Mitchell and Nick Tangborn and Ken were at the show, and Barbara and Nick were like, you should get Matt to play bass with the Posies, because they were talking about getting back together.
Yeah.
And so never meeting Ken ever, only talking to him over the phone, I basically joined the band. It's funny because I was supposed to go to Seattle to do like a week of rehearsals before we did this two-week tour. And we got a phone call for Oranger from Guided by Voices saying, hey, we want you guys to come out and do a couple of shows with us and do our big Postal Blowfish party out in Lawrence, Kansas, which is their big web fan club thing. And we were like, shh, we can't say no to that. But it was like driving from California to, I think it was, we did a show in Denver, Tulsa, and Lawrence, Kansas were the three shows. A lot of driving for just three shows. Yeah. I mean, I think we got paid like $500 for the whole thing, but we just so wanted
excited
to do it.
Yeah, we just
wanted to do it, so we did it. And I just remember sitting in the back of the van learning, you know, like 35, 40 Posey songs every day. I'm just like, oh God, what am I doing? So I didn't do any rehearsals or anything. I showed up, did 1 3-hour rehearsal, and went on tour with them.
Wow.
And I'd never met them in person until Ken picked me up at the airport. So
what is that? Is it just awkward?
Were
you a fan of the band?
Yeah, of course I was. Yeah. But I mean, it wasn't really weird. At that point, I was ready. I had gone to Oranger and said, look, I'm going to join the Posies. I'm going to do this. I need to do something else. Otherwise, I'm going to go nuts. And Mike was like, okay, well, as long as you can balance it out and it's not going to affect Oranger. I'm like, sure, it won't affect it. And of course it did. But it opened a can of worms for everybody to kind of start doing other things, which probably in hindsight is a good thing.
Yeah.
So everybody can kind of expand a little. But I had no fear for it whatsoever. The only weird part was kind of when I'm getting off the plane in Seattle and I'm like, wow, I have never met these guys at all, and I'm getting ready to go on tour
weird,
and
like,
play a bunch of songs with these dudes. So anyway, it worked out, and here I am. I'm, what's
still
2013? I joined in 2001, so 12 years.
Wow.
And they still haven't asked me to join. So
they just call you like, hey, will you do this tour?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, come on and do this. No, actually, we were all, Darius and I were also, again, a first for the Posies. We were one of the first rhythm sections to co-write a record with them.
Oh, cool.
So that's two for me now, Ian and the Posies.
Yeah.
So that was a lot of fun. We did Every Kind of Light. We all kind of wrote that one together in the studio. We didn't, you know, it was one of those things where we showed up, we had the time booked, we had a budget, but we didn't know if we were going to last past Monday, and we fly in on Friday, and we're like, okay, so you got any songs? Mm-hmm. You got any songs? Mm-hmm. Well, let's just go in the studio and see what happens. And it was one of those things where we had 14 or 15 days, and we wrote a song a day.
Wow.
And it was just cranking it out. Everybody was just on the same page. And you get in there at 10 a.m. and you leave at 10 p.m. and you just work.
Wow. Where is it at now? Where's the Where's the Posies project at now?
We just played earlier this year at Peter Buck has a festival down in Todos Santos in Mexico. Oh, and it's nice. Like 3 weeks long.
And was Alejandro playing that too?
Alejandro yeah. played it, Chuck Prophet, the Baseball Project. I mean, there's a ton of bands that played it. The Twin Tones from Mexico City, one of my favorite surf bands. They're badass. They dress up like all mariachis, and they just played just blistering, like Ennio Morricone meets, you know, The Ventures meets
wow.
meets the Agent Orange or something. I mean, it's wow. really cool. They have a guy that just does special effects and plays trumpet, and he does like horse, you know,
yeah, yeah,
sounds
yeah.
and pew, gunshot sounds and shit. That's it's awesome. Awesome. Yeah, they're really cool. The Twin Tones. Their stuff's really hard to find. I guess a couple of the guys can't come into the States. But that's cool. Danny from Los Straitjackets, I think, discovered those guys and took them on tour to Europe, and somehow or another they wound up playing that festival. In fact, this is a funny story. Is we were the headliner for the week the Posies were playing.
Uh-huh.
And so you fly down there like on Tuesday, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you play shows every night. So like Thursday, Friday is at this hotel. They book out all these VIP packages for people at the hotel.
Right.
And so it's like if you live there, it's $1 to get in or something. Oh, wow. It's really ridiculous. And then Saturday night is the big free show downtown. And so all these bands play. And those guys played before us. And Todos Santos is a sleepy little arty surf community, you know, about an hour and a half north of Cabo. And there's like two paved roads and one light in the town. It's really tiny. And so the Twin Tones, being from Mexico City, kind of had home field advantage.
Yeah.
And they played at 10, and I didn't realize this until Michael Stiper, somebody said, well, you know, in Todos Santos, 9 o'clock is midnight. And we're like, well, shit, we're playing at midnight. We're hosed. You know,
oh,
nobody's
no.
going to
yeah.
be there. And the Twin Tones played before us and just killed it, you know, probably 1,500 people at this, you know, the plaza in the center of town. And, you know, they come off stage. They've just killed the show. They're awesome. Everybody's there. So we're backstage. We come out and there's like 15 people. Everybody left. And that's we just so kind of look at each other and it's like, where's the tequila, boys?
Yeah.
This is going to be a quick one. 10 and 2, as we'd say. 10 songs, 2 encores. Here we go.
That's it.
Yeah, it was fun, though. And so that was the last thing we did.
Who else hanging out there? Michael Stipes just hanging out?
Yeah, he
did
was
he
down
play
there.
Or anything, or just hung out?
He was just hanging out. Mills was there the week before. Scott McCoy was playing there with the Baseball Project. Steve Wynn was there. One night, John and Ken, Scott McCoy and myself, I was playing drums, actually, and Robin Hitchcock.
I saw a picture of that.
Yeah, we decided to do the first side of the White Album.
That's awesome.
Just on the cuff. You know, the tequila's good there, man. Oh, it's real good. So we were very inspired. Yeah, it was a real blast. The Posies are getting ready to do later this year in October and November. They're doing, and I won't, Darius and I won't be a part of it, but they're doing Frosting on the Beater with the original lineup.
Oh, wow.
And Amazing Disgrace with the original lineup in the same night. They're doing both albums in Spain for, like, I think maybe 10 dates. I'm not sure.
Wow. Is that where Ken Stringfellow lives?
No, Ken and John both live in France now.
Okay.
And Darius is in Vancouver. So I'm the only person left in the States in that band.
Why did they choose that?
I think, well, Ken and John both married European ladies, but I think they were both kind of tired of the U.S. as well, tired of Seattle, just looking for a change of pace. I know Darius was kind of tired of it, wanted to go to Vancouver. I think he misses football more than he misses Seattle, though. But and happy birthday. It was his birthday yesterday.
Oh, happy birthday.
But yeah, those guys, it's funny. I just think that John wants to follow Ken, or Ken wants to follow John. So they just can't be away from each other. There's so much love.
Yeah,
is what it is.
So what's it like living in Palm Springs? I went there when we were on tour with Ian together,
yeah,
and I
yeah.
stayed there with you, and I loved it. But I've always thought since then, it must be strange to live there.
It is.
It's kind of an isolated island in the middle of a...
Well, the cool thing about it is you're only an hour and a half away from the beach.
Yeah.
You're only an hour and a half away from L.A. So you're really close to anything. If you really want to go do it, you can. You know, if you want to go, you know, there's not
there
a lot
of
shows.
LA that you'd live in that would take you an hour and a half to get to where
yeah,
you
exactly.
need to get to
if
anyway.
If I lived up in the north end of the valley and I had to go out to the west side, it would take me an hour and a half to get there. So, but you know, I don't really go out to LA that much. I have a friend that lives out in Santa Monica that I visit all the time, and I try to get out there for some shows. I'm actually going to go I think it's on the 13th of July. I'm going to go see Lonnie Trevino Jr. and the Fastball Guys.
Oh, excellent.
I'm going to go to the 90s throwback tour at the Greek. So excellent. I get back just in time. I'm going to see the Flaming Groovies the night before for their reunion show, and then I'm going to go see those guys. So,
oh, that's great.
I'm looking forward to that. That should be fun.
Are you going to play when you're there?
I do, actually. I've been playing guitar in a rockabilly band.
Oh, no shit.
Sort of a rockabilly, roots, blues, surfy thing called Plan B. And, I sort of approach it from a surfy angle.
Yeah.
And I still have a little bit of chicken picking skills and stuff. And my guitar playing's, you know, it's not great, but it's not terrible. It's fun. And, oh. we have a lot of fun doing it. And it actually, you know, we do a lot of gigs. We do maybe upwards of 6-7 gigs a month. So that's pretty good when we're, you know, where everybody's getting paid. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm also working at a place called Bar in Palm Springs that's opened up. Some friends started, and it's a venue and a craft beer place.
Oh, wow,
that's
cool.
Really cool, and I'm doing a lot of sound there. I have a DJ night that I do now on Tuesdays called
nice.
Forbidden Lounge.
And what do you play?
What do you think? Tiki, jazz, yeah. Lounge, exotica, yeah. All that weird stuff that I torture people with in the van.
No,
I get to do
in
a nightclub now.
I got to say, that was it was a great musical. I came out with so much stuff. Richard Howley, like off of that tour, I came out with tons of music from you.
Yeah.
So how did you meet Ian? How did that ever happen?
I met Ian again through Barbara Mitchell. She's responsible for me in the Lossy Coils, and she's responsible for me in the Posies. So,
wow,
she seems to be a great connector of things. And I'd seen Ian. Shit, I think Zeke had taken me. God, I want to say in like 91 or 92, I was here.
Oh, early on.
And I saw him in the long hair days. I think I saw the Raging Honkies open up for him at. I want to say it was at Steamboat. It might have been, and I hated it. I didn't want to be there. Yeah. I didn't like any of that stuff at the time. You know, I was into the Police.
Yeah,
I wanted to be a ska band. I didn't want to see a bunch of dudes playing blues.
Yeah,
I was just kind of, it wasn't my thing. But you know, I didn't. You know, we're all young and stupid at some point in our lives.
Yeah,
but I hadn't really met or talked to Ian until one night. Barbara and I were hanging out, and I think she had called, and we just started talking, and he was like, you know, we should play, and. We kind of talked about it back and forth, and then I was out in New York City. I'd just done a director for a summer camp, rock camp for kids out in Boston, and then I'd been hired to do some work for Sprint in New York, and I was there for a few weeks, and Ian called me about the tour that you were on and said, hey, I don't think you'll be able to do this, but I need a bass player for this tour, and I was like, you know what? I can do it. And he goes, can you be out here in a couple of days? And I was like, yeah. I'm done. I just finished here in New York. I can be out there.
We just played like two or three shows with George or something, and you were there.
I was there, yeah. You guys did a couple of shows, and then I think we did... Well, I think what happened, I had seen you guys... I had done... What was the deal? We knew that I would be playing, and that it was George's last few shows, and then... Maybe it was like a week or... I can't remember if I went home and came back, and then we did like... A couple of rehearsals,
something
and
like
did
that.
A tour.
Yeah.
It was something like that. So we'd kind of known. I remember, what was it? It was Sam's, I think, in the Continental. I wound up singing and playing tambourine on 30 Days or something.
Yeah.
And that's how it kind of started. And I remember the last night of the tour in Houston with Jan and all those guys in the hotel.
Oh, Jesus.
And George saying, yeah, I used to do pastry. And I was like, hey, I used to do pastry too.
Yeah.
And Ian going, oh, fuck, two bass players that do pastry.
Jeez. Well, that was the most fun I've ever had on a tour.
That was a blast.
It was a great group of guys, and you and I were roommates.
Ann Arbor.
We had a great time all the time. Ann Arbor with the Fried Piper coming around.
We did have a lot of fun that tour. New York City was a blast too, man.
Yeah.
We had a great time.
So what happens now? You go back to Palm Springs this week?
Yep, doing work. I'm doing sound at Bar. Uh-huh. I immediately get off the plane, and I have Forbidden Lounge on Tuesday. My buddy Mike Bent is the other DJ that does it with me when I'm gone, and we usually split it up. I do a lot of the loungy, jazzy shit early on, and then he'll
come
out.
Are you spinning vinyl, or are you just going from the laptop?
Both. I'm doing both. I'm doing a lot of vinyl and digital stuff. He does only vinyl. He's a vinyl purist, as they call them, and but he's also got the black crack addiction, where he'll go out and he'll spend $50 on whatever the new latest release is of whoever. He's more in tune with the kids than I am as far as that stuff goes. He's really on top of that. And a lot of the guys at bar that run that place are younger. They're in their late to mid-20s. So they're all into their thing. And so we get a lot. I get a lot of education from those guys now about what's newer and hip. Because when I looked at the Coachella lineup, I was like, okay, I know the Stone Roses.
But
okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And everybody else was like, who the hell are the Stone Roses?
Yeah,
I was why are they headlining?
Did you go? No.
Oh. I don't go to that stuff anymore. You know, in fact, last year when we were in Tulsa and booked on back to Austin to try and get into ACL the last day, and we got here, and I think the Stooges were playing.
Yeah.
And I didn't even go and see a band. I just sat backstage and drank free Tito's or whatever was there. And Ian and I just, we were so tired, didn't want to listen to any music. And it's just, I can't stand crowds anymore.
No.
You know, I don't want to do it. Even if I have a seat or something or, it's just, I don't want to do it. Especially Coachella, man. It's so fucking hot.
Yeah, that just
It's
seems
just
insane.
Miserable. And usually the bands that play at Coachella are going to play at ACL if I'm out here. So
yeah,
I'll see them here. But a lot of I can stream it now.
That's true.
I can stream.
People did.
I can stream Coachella the first week. I did it last year. It was awesome. I had my computer hooked up to my big TV and my stereo, and I just sat there with the cold iced tea, and I was like, wow, this is great.
Oh, yeah. No crowds, no heat.
Yeah, you're not going to get any closer to the stage. You're going to wind up looking at the same.
And it's going to sound so much better, too.
Oh, absolutely. And you're just going to wind up looking at the video screen that they're showing you at home. You know, and and it sounds better. If it's windy out there, you know what live sound is outside with wind. It sucks.
It's terrible.
It's terrible. It's just blows all over the place.
So you guys just did this short tour. Are you guys going to go in and record more?
What's
going on?
We did a Pacific Northwest tour.
Okay.
So we did like 4 dates up there.
I saw that.
And then we had a couple of days off, and then we came down here and did, I want to say 8 dates, maybe 8 or 9 dates.
Tulsa, San Antonio, Austin, Houston, Dallas.
Yeah, and then we went up to Abilene, Lubbock.
Oh, yeah, the good places.
The sweet spots. And Oklahoma City. So we did a good, kind of that circuit that Ian always does, that little run. We did that, which was fun. And then we're doing a run at the end of August. We're going to play at Bar in Palm Springs on the 29th. The 30th at the Mint. The 31st, we're playing with an Almond Brothers tribute band in Santa Cruz.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And then the 1st, we're playing at Pier 23 in San Francisco for the America's Cup.
Oh, wow.
So that should be fun.
Yeah.
Looking forward to that. And so in between that, I have a bunch of gigs out in the desert. And I do sound at the club as well.
Yeah.
So that keeps me busy on the weekends, which is good. And a little bit of management here and there never hurts. So
no.
Helping Ian try and organize some of the West Coast stuff so he doesn't have to, setting up some of the gear.
Right.
I have enough gear there that I think I could probably get everybody covered and they wouldn't have to bring anything.
Oh, so no one has to bring anything.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Got enough amps and guitars. And
is Ian still making amps?
He is. He just met some guy, though, when we were in, where were we? In Fort Worth. He went somewhere and this guy is making these amps. I want to say it's Jackson, but not Jackson, Charbel Jackson. And they're these, apparently they're really small, like you could throw it in your gig bag kind of amp, that are just super killer. And they have one tube in it, like a 6L6 or a 12AX7, I'm not sure, you have to ask him. But he was raving about them. He was saying they're the best amp ever made and that he has to get one of these. And they're super small and super tiny because he was, the bass amps nowadays are ridiculously small. You can get a dinky one that you can throw in your gig bag and all you need is a cab.
Yeah.
And he was kind of complaining about that, and then finally this came up, and I was like, see? Somebody did come up with
a
guitar
amp. All you need
amp.
Is a cab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh,
and just
great.
this little amp, probably twice the size of that little guy or something. So I didn't see it because I didn't want to go listen to him talk turkey for an hour and a half about
that. All scientific.
Oh, I know they get real deep on it, and it's like, I just wanted to sit and read.
That's what you got to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So the place is called Bard?
Bar.
B-A-R. In Palm Springs. So anyone listening, you're in Palm Springs, what do you do? Wednesday nights, you said?
Tuesday nights is the Forbidden Lounge.
Yeah, Forbidden
Bar Lounge. BarWasTaken.com is their website.
Okay, Bar Was Taken.
Yep.
And what's the name of the rockabilly band?
Plan B. Mm-hmm.
And of course, Ian Moore and the Lossy Coils.
Yep, we're always out there beating the pavement.
And at some point, if the Posies get back together
next
with
year,
the newer lineup,
I think
more
next
stuff.
Year. Yeah, next year looks like there'll probably be something on the burner.
Any Rocky dates?
Nope. I haven't been playing with Rocky for the last year and a half, maybe 2 years now. I think Jagar's band, The Hounds of Baskerville has been backing him up. It's funny because we were at that festival in Norway, and I was like, man, you should just start a band and back up your dad. I was like, don't.
Yeah, there goes my job.
So, but I'm really happy for him, and I think he and Kaylee, who's in the band with him, boyfriend and girlfriend now,
right,
have been together for a few years, and they seem really happy, and seems like everything's running real smooth, and Rocky's doing really well. In fact, he's playing like 2 days before us in Santa Cruz, where we're playing with the Allman Brothers tribute band, and I was like, shit, I wish I knew. I'd go up there a little early and check it out, surprise him. I did actually surprise him when Aukerville was backing him up.
Oh, yeah.
They were in L.A., and I told Jagar, I said, don't tell anybody, just put me on the list. I'm gonna come to the show, and I want to check it out.
Yeah.
And so I went, and it was fun. I went backstage, and Rocky's like, hey, you! He never called me by my name ever. Never once. He was always like, hey, man! All right, cool, see you later.
Oh, that's nice, though, man.
I gave him a cool skull mug, so I don't think he'll ever forget that.
That's good.
And he loves talking about the Powerpuff Girls, so...
Really?
I think that's his favorite cartoon in the world. That's Somebody weird. Sent him a Powerpuff Girl Strat.
Really?
Yeah, he loves it. That's his favorite guitar.
Was there anything I'm missing?
I don't think so. Show? I'm missing you.
I miss you. I'm glad we're going to go hang out. We're going to go eat some barbecue with your family.
Yeah, man.
Zeke.
This is great.
Zeke and Sally.
Really got a good thing going on. Let's get this on XM. Let's get it on Sirius. Yeah. Let's get it up.
You hear that out there, people. Help me get on Sirius.
Yeah, not man.
But XM merged with Sirius, right? Whatever. Yeah. Just get me somewhere.
Some Sirius XM.
Put me somewhere.
Let's get it happening.
Buy some advertising.
Absolutely.
From Ian Moore and the Lossy Coils, Oranger and the Posies, Rocky Erickson, countless bands, Michael DeBar, the drummer from A Drunken Robin Hitchcock in Mexico. My friend Matt Harris, thank you.
Thanks.
One of my favorite people of all time, seriously.
Thanks, buddy. Love you.
Yeah. Matt Harris. All right, yeah, I played one of my own songs because Matt played bass on that song. And that's Cullen from the Lossy Coils. That's a whole gang from, part of the gang, half of the Ian Moore gang jamming on that song. Man, Matt Harris is such a great guy. One of my favorite people. He was my roommate on that tour, best tour I've ever been on, and just the best time I've ever had with people traveling. And really, he was a huge part of that. He was my companion. All right. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Like our Facebook page, How Did I Get Here? You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram. I am at Johnny Gowdy, and I will be posting pictures. I'm currently thinking about going and getting all of my hair cut off. Beetle Bailey style. That's a weird reference. Beetle Bailey. Weird. How about some more Ian Moore and the Lossy Coils? I'd like to thank Matt for stopping by. I'm glad he was here. He's in Palm Springs now. Hey, thank you for listening. Let's check out some more Ian Moore and the Lossy Coils.
My head is filled with inspiration. Takes me places no one else is around. I'm riding on the wave that's cresting. The problems left me, and I'm getting straight out of town. I'm finding it hard to be someone, always lost in the crowd. People say they've got so much more to give than I've given it out. Sensation, a foreign nation, but no one knows who I am. I know that only friends can find me. They don't mind me being just who I am, 'cause I find it